Welcome to the eGovernance Academy podcast to discover the future of governance. eGovernance Academy has assisted digital transformation globally in more than 130 countries. Our experts will share their insights and worldwide examples on how digital technology could benefit every society. Tune in for the Digital Government Podcast every Wednesday.
Welcome to eGovernance Academy podcast, and I'm happy to host today President Thomas Ilves, who is also eGovernance Academy Supervisory Board member from this year. And today we will discuss about election security. And if you're discussing about the election security, what about President Ilves has been speaking and written a lot, we probably need to discuss about the various aspects, both from technical security, information security, disinformation issues, and many other aspects. And this year has been definitely, actually, as many others, election year, but the international audience has been focusing definitely mostly to the American presidential elections, and around it has been a lot of noise about their security also. So President Ilves, do you think that American elections were secure enough and we can be happy about the security situation around those elections? And I will not ask about the election results, definitely.
Okay, well, I mean, let's do this piece by piece. First of all, as you rightly said, the idea of election security has in general covered a broad range of topics. From very detailed issues of cybersecurity, ranging all the way to attempts at spreading disinformation, misinformation, even with the active participants of people in political parties. And we have seen this in many, many countries over the years. And when I talk about disinformation, some of it can be pretty sophisticated, as in the case of hacking into Emmanuel Macron's server in 2017 and hacking into Hillary Clinton's server in 2016 to spread disinformation. So it all overlaps. Now, in discussions of election security in the more digital realm, at least it seems that this year in the U.S. elections, the U.S. had taken some fairly strong steps to prevent some of the things that we saw in 2016, but we don't really know. I mean, we know that in 2016, and this came out later in 2017 and 18, that the Russians had actually hacked into voter rolls, that is to say, who was voting. And we don't know more than that because Department of Homeland Defense was fairly, vague about what was going on. And we also know that an employee of the National Security Agency leaked the internal document of the NSA that actually said there were far more breaches of voter rolls by the Russians in 2016, and she went to jail. So we don't really know. So all we have to go on is what the Department of Homeland Security says about these elections, and what they do say is the elections were more secure than in the past. So let's hope so. And so I won't get into the whole disinformation side of things because that is an ongoing process. We see RT participating or generating all kinds of disinformation even as I speak. But on the issue of particularly voting security, we have seen a lot of noise over the years. Some of this is justified, some of this is not. Almost all of the discussion has been about hacking into electronic voting machines. Because in the United States, you have little computers where you press that when you go to a polling place, you press a button and you vote for a candidate. And some of these companies have not been the most secure in the past because they operate over the internet with incredibly unbelievably low levels of security. I should say, as an aside, that this is the kind of nonsense that we in Estonia have to deal with. We say, well, see, they don't work in the U.S. Why should they work in Estonia? Whereas the Estonian system is extremely secure. And since we use the same single system for everything from banking to legal documents, and none of those have ever been hacked, so why the hell would you think that they could hack the electoral results? But in the United States, these machines are known to be incredibly insecure. So when the U.S. says that the elections were secure, we don't know what they did with these electronic voting machines to be able to say that, but we can assume that they are right. Some states stopped using voting machines and went over to paper ballots. And a lot of the noise is, oh, we have to have paper ballots. We don't believe in voting, electronic voting machines. Where the intellectual flaw comes in is that the act of voting when you cast the vote, is only one step in a long process from beginning to end is all vulnerable, because it's not only the act of voting. In fact, we know from the Russian attempts that you can alter voting lists, or at least they had the possibility to vote to alter voting lists or election rolls, so that, if you change a person's name in the list of people entitled to vote, that will disqualify him from voting, right? So that's one aspect of digital security in elections, and you can change addresses and you can do all those things. Then you have this step of voting, which is what 99.999, 100% of the discussion is, oh my God, is the machine safe? But then after that, after the vote is cast, you have another series of operations that can also be altered. And I have seen no one really talk about that, which is you have a voting machine. It registers Biden or Trump. All right, so then all of the votes in that precinct are put together. Well, putting it together, you can change it, not just when you vote, but when you put it together. Those votes from every single precinct or place where you vote are then summed up for the whole area. And those are summed up then going up and up and up. And every step of that way is digital, and without, at least to my knowledge, without the usual necessary safeguards of two-factor authentication and end-to-end encryption. So when DHS, Department of Homeland Security, says that these were the most secure elections ever, we don't know what exactly they are talking about. But take their word for it. And I'm sure I know that they have put a lot of effort and money into this since the revelations of 2016. And then you have this, sort of these quirks of the United States that make things more difficult for controlling, because we do know that at least as of recently, the states are in charge of election security. And some states have even rejected any federal government role in election security, relying on their own experts, which in some cases may not be the smartest thing to do. And so, as I said, what we have to go on is what the federal government of the United States says, that these were more secure. And I'm sure they were, because the 2016 results showed how great the possibilities of affecting the cybersecurity of elections, in fact, were. There's one more point about the United States that comes out of its unique history, but to us in living in a place, well, in most countries in Europe, the idea of voter registration seems kind of ridiculous. But constitutionally, legally, and philosophically, anyone who is a citizen and of majority age, that is in most countries 18 these days, has the right to vote. In the United States, you have the right to vote only if you are registered. So even if you're a citizen, and lots of people are citizens but are not registered to vote, you can't vote. You have to go separately and register. So that even that strikes me as a bizarre element. And I think only the UK has something like that, where you have to separately register. Because as I said, if you're a citizen, that is one of the definitions of citizenship in a democracy, is that if you're a citizen, basically three things. I mean, they have to let you into your own country. And secondly, you get the vote. I mean, that's really kind of the basic, most basic aspects of citizenship in a democracy. And so, yeah, okay, the U.S. has this bizarre registration thing, and then they say, well, that's because we don't want to keep lists of citizens. And it's like, well, okay, I mean, that's your choice. But then you have to basically not acknowledge that you are not fully democratic. Sorry, it's just not the way it goes. And especially given the wholesale rejection and elimination of voters, I mean, commonly known as voter suppression, which seems to touch something that states in the South tend to do towards people who are not white. So not only the South, I mean, I think it was in Kansas, like 200,000 black people were just like, whoops, you're not on the rolls anymore. And on top of that, there is this kind of unique American and sort of solution, way of doing things, which goes back to what I said about citizenship, is that you can be eliminated from the voting rolls if you have not exercised your right to vote in the last 2, 3, or 4 elections. Now, why that should be something the government determines, that, I mean, there's no laws. You didn't vote the last 3 times, therefore you're no longer eligible to vote. I mean, I don't understand that. I mean, it's my right. Do I want to go vote? Do I not want to go vote? I'm a citizen. If I'm a citizen, I want to go and I would decide, well, the last 3 elections didn't really float my boat. I didn't really care about the candidates. I just let it be. But now I'm going to go because I really want to support Donald Trump. But then they say you can't vote because you didn't vote the last 3 times. So these are the idiosyncrasies of U.S. elections, which are, which I have to unfortunately say, neither Americans understand how idiosyncratic their voting system is, nor do people in the rest of the world understand how idiosyncratic their voting system is. But certainly, you know, claims to being the oldest democracy in the world when you can just eliminate voters because, you know, you can find out they have black names or something, doesn't really strike me as being a full-fledged democracy. Be that as it may, in this case, we have the word of the DHS saying that these elections were free of interference and more than in the past. And I can even take their word for it and say, okay, well, good. The voter suppression incidents that, which there were apparently many, have not yet been investigated. And I assume that under the Biden administration, they will take a closer look at that. I think that the U.S. electoral system is in need of overhaul in this regard. But then again, as I said, the people who are critics also kind of focused on just one thing and not the security of elections from virtually the registration of voters all the way to the end with the tabulation of elections. And I should say that when it comes to all the noise that we've heard for the past 4 years about electronic voting machines being bad, that's like, that is also just one step, because in fact, you can do the manipulations even if you vote by hand on paper. because you can manipulate the voting list. And also on the, once the vote has been cast, even if it's a paper ballot, the tabulation process also is something which is, I mean, it's, that's all digital also, no matter what people say. You can count by hand and elect in one place, but you still put then the numbers in and it goes, continues up the line digitally. So, well, that's my sort of take on it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think this is very relevant what you said, that we need to consider that the whole election process consists many, many elements where the fraud may take place or interference could take place. So I think it's relevant to many other countries also, because in most of the countries there are endless number of election units, and then we all need to calculate all together how many votes one or another candidate got. So I think the idea of considering integrity of election process in all aspects, starting from the voters list and ending up with summarizing the votes from various districts of elections is critical. Many other countries has exercised elections also during last year. Is there any other remarks from other countries you have been looking at after about the digital interference to the election processes?
Well, we've noticed in other elections, and this is because of reporting. It's not that, I mean, I don't, if you don't see news stories about sort of interference in the digital voting process, then you don't know about it. What we do know is that there's been an awful lot of disinformation in the elections, most recently in Georgia, where we saw all kinds of actions on the part of the Russians, also by domestic parties running themselves. Everyone is accusing everyone else of disinformation. We just had elections in Moldova, where again, with heavy Russian support of one candidate who lost anyway, right? So, but you don't know, maybe. And then, of course, in terms of election interference, I mean, we don't really have to think in digital terms. We just, there were elections 3 months ago in the summer in Belarus, and everything indicates that the incumbent president Lukashenko got 7% of the vote. Yet, I mean, this comes down to the old Stalinist explanation: everyone can vote. But what matters is who counts the elections or the results. And I mean, it seems that in authoritarian, undemocratic countries like Russia, Belarus, they finally, these authoritarians have figured out that, well, getting 99.9% of the vote, as happened during the Soviet period, does not convince people. So now it's usually between like 70 and 79% of the population in these votes, in these elections, seem to support the, you know, Putin or in this case, Lukashenko. And so, I mean, there was even a Russian commentator in the Russian media who said, well, that was really stupid of Lukashenko to claim such a high number. He should have simply said, well, I got 55%. That would have been good enough. I mean, if you're thinking in these terms, it shows that how ingrained the idea is of manipulating elections. My favorite example was in the two elections back in Russia, where Rostov-on-Don reported 138% of the population voted. And the backstory to that, which came out a year or two later, was that head of the election committee in Rostov-on-Don got this phone call saying, give Putin 71% or something like that. And so the guy said, okay, but what about the other parties? And he said, oh, give them what they got. And so they added up all the votes. And so It was 134%. I mean, you know, but we're talking about democracies, right? I mean, I don't even know why we bother talking about country. I mean, we have, you know, there, you know, the violence in Belarus is horrible, but no one ever thought, no one thinks that Russia or Belarus or similar countries have free and fair elections and the numbers don't count at all to anyone. I mean, no one believes them. But when it comes to real democracies, obviously it makes a big difference. And I mean, in the case of the 2000 election in the United States, in what, because of their ridiculous, unproportional system of the Electoral College, they it came down to one state, which was Florida. And the difference between Bush and Gore there was 538 votes. This is in a state of like, you know, 15 million people. You had 538 votes difference. So all of that, I mean, a lot of the problems, of course, actually come from non-digital matters. I mentioned the Electoral College in the United States, where which is where, first of all, the popular vote does not count at all. Only who wins a first past the post election in an individual state. And the weight of the state is equal to the number of representatives you have in the House of Representatives and your senators. What that means is you can have a state such as South Dakota, which is physically huge, but it has 800,000 people in it. It has one member of the House of Representatives, and it has two senators. So they have three votes. California has 40 million people. It's 40 times the size of South Dakota, or 50 times the size of South Dakota. Yet they only have 20 times the number of votes in the Electoral College. And that is how you end up, if you sum this up across state, that is how you end up with results where Hillary Clinton can have 3 million more votes than Donald Trump across the country, but still lose the election. And you know, same, why is Donald Trump making such a big deal out of individual states? Because you have a first past the post system with disproportionate representation in the Electoral College, so that, I mean, he may end up losing the popular by 7 million votes, but still could.
Maybe in the election.
So, I mean, which brings me to the point which I was trying to make is that, well, election security, if you have an lopsided, disproportionate electoral system, it doesn't matter. I mean, so what? You know, if you're, you know, the Russians managed to change some votes, if in fact the whole system is an 18th century, literally an 18th century invention of the time when and travel was via horse. And so they invented this system so not to give big states too much power, because the presidential candidates couldn't go to all of the states to talk there because it took like, you know, 6 or 7 days to go somewhere by horse.
Yeah, but definitely the high risk is that even in this system, and as you just brought the example when 500 votes in Florida decided the election result, also the disinformation or interference to vote counts may make the change.
Yes, absolutely. And certainly that was what the argument was regarding, it wasn't only Florida in 2000, but there's a whole book written by Katie Holmes Jameson, on how in crucial votes in the Midwest, that's like Michigan and Wisconsin, in the numbers difference were so small that clearly Russian disinformation could have had a major effect. It's also important to note, which we have a more refined view of Russian disinformation. It's much more of a seeding factor, meaning you plant some information. Because most of the, I mean, the disinformation is not that everyone's reading RT. It's that you have people who spread this and spread this, and then it gets more and more spread. So, and of course, all of the new and people are also, we know from studies, are much more likely to spread wild news than they are to spread like boring news. So, I mean, spreading an article about, you know, Hillary Clinton's economic policy is not going to, is not, I mean, people don't do that. Saying that Hillary Clinton is involved in a wild pedophile sex cult, of course, gets spread a lot. Right? So, and so disinformation moves fast. And I mean, I think it was Harry Truman or Winston Churchill. One of them, yeah, Winston Churchill said that by the time a lie is traveled around the world, the truth hasn't even got its pants put on.
I agree very much. I agree very much. And I think the takeout from this discussion is that we need to be careful, both technically but also mentally, because I think this kind of disinformation, what takes us mentally or takes us over mentally, is at the same level as the technical threats what we may face during the election process. And to fight with the technical threats is somehow easier because it's just technical issues. You need to have the same level technical guys as your enemy, or even better ones. But if this kind of fake news and disinformation is spreaded, it's even pretty normal people we know and we meet every day in our office as our friends, they may spread it because they even don't know it's disinformation if it's formulated properly. So I think the takeout is that we need to be careful just and think more than act.
Which is impossible for people to do. I mean, there's a whole big, fantastic book by Daniel Kahneman on this called Slow and Fast Thinking. And generally, when you think fast, you're actually, it's your emotions thinking. And when you think slowly, you can be quite rational. But, you know, it's much easier to say, oh, Hillary Clinton's a pedophile.
Share. Yeah, this is true. So let us think slowly. And thank you very much, President Ilves, for this great conversation. And thank you for listening to eGovernance Academy podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by eGovernance Academy. Tune in on next Wednesday.